I hope you did receive a warm welcome on your way in, and I hope you know how excited that we are that you are joining us for worship today. We're in the middle of a message series called Seven Habits of Highly Effective Christians, and I thought that video was a pretty good picture of the habit we're going to be talking about today. It's the habit of loving everyone always. Can we say this phrase out loud together? Say it with me. Love everyone always. I got to tell you, the first time I saw that video, I was a little nervous for Valentine, the caretaker of this lioness. I wasn't sure, like, is this a predator hunting its prey, or is there a genuine relationship going on here? And what changed my opinion was, as they sort of tumbled to the ground, did you see the way the lion turned her teeth away from the man's head? And instead, did you know, she just kind of nuzzled up her neck as close as she could get to the neck of Valentine. I'm not a pet person, but even I can see in that embrace, that is the embrace of genuine affection. Now, genuine affection is part of what we're going to be talking about today. It shows up in our Bible reading, Romans chapter 12, verse 10. This is the first half of the verse. Let's read this out loud together. Love each other with genuine affection. The idea of this message series is, as we practice these habits, God is going to be at work in us. The transformational power of God's love is going to be at work in us, helping us grow, maturing us so that more and more all the time we become people who, like our God, we love everyone always. We love each other with genuine affection. I'm not a pet person, but I am a Jesus person. So what we're going to do today is kind of go on a little bit of a tour. And what are the things that we can learn from Jesus? Jesus, the one who's called the Lamb of God, who becomes the Lion of Judah. What does Jesus of Nazareth have to teach us about how we can be people who love everyone always, who love with genuine affection? To get us started, I want to talk a little bit about mirror neurons. The people who study our brains, it's fascinating to me, the people who are learning so much about how our brains work. And what they tell us, what neuroscience has been telling us for a couple of decades now, is our prefrontal cortex is just loaded with millions and millions of millions of what they call mirror neurons. And what mirror neurons are helpful for is pretty much everything. If you want to figure out, how do I grasp a new skill? How do I learn new information, take in new information? How do I develop a socially connection with another human being? It has everything to do with the work, the role of our mirror neurons. And this type of connection, if you look at a baby starts to develop socially these kinds of connections. Mirror neurons are very much involved in this process. So again, if you look at people who study the brain and then people who study childhood development, you will see people talking about something that they just simply call mirroring, where new parents will be right in the face of their newborn child and looking each other directly, very close, very intimate, and then kind of this mimicking behavior starts to happen. What they tell us is babies at 2 to 3 weeks after being born are able to start mimicking what they see in front of them, the face of the person in front of them. Now, part of what I find fascinating is it takes 18 to 24 months, they tell us, before a child is able to recognize themselves in a mirror. So they'll see their reflection, but they're not able to make the connection that, oh, that's actually me. I'm looking at myself. But long before we're able to recognize ourselves in a mirror, we are developing a sense of self. And again, what people who study our brains and study child development tell us, we develop initially, we begin to develop our sense of self by looking at another. We develop our sense of self by looking at another person, by seeing another person. There's a guy named Dr. Jim Wilder. He is a neurotheologian, which I think is a fantastic title. If you're at a dinner party, somebody asks you what you do, I'm a neurotheologian. Yeah. So all that means is he goes to seminary and he gets his master's degree in theology, but then at that seminary he continues his course of study and he gets his PhD in clinical psychology. So he's a very well-trained Christian counselor. And he's been doing this counseling work now for over 40 years. For more than four decades, people have been coming into this guy's office seeking help. wanting to experience some kind of healing or growth in their life. And over these 40 years of observation, and they've actually been able to do research and verify it's more than just an observation, he has discovered there's one key variable that is the difference maker. Someone who comes to see him, someone who comes, goes through the counseling process, and it helps, it works, they grow, they experience healing, and someone who doesn't. Someone who just kind of remains stuck. Lots of people go to see counselors and doesn't make any kind of difference. They remain stuck in these unhealthy thought patterns, unhealthy behavioral patterns, and he says, here's the key differentiating variable. It's connection with an irreplaceable other who has good intentions for you. It's love. Do you have a faith life that tells you there's a God who loves you? Do you have close relationships, whether it's with family or friends, where you know you are loved? If you want to grow, if you want to heal, he's saying this is what makes all the difference. Connection with an irreplaceable other who has good intentions for you. And so you start to see why mirroring is so important for early childhood development. As parents are looking at their children in this face-to-face, intimate, relational kind of context, and the parent smiles, and the child learns to respond back, copy back that behavior they're seeing. They smile back. It's firing off those mirror neurons, but more than the mirror neurons, then it starts to develop neural pathways. So again, what brain science is telling us, the people who study our brains, they're telling us, you and I, our brains are not designed for us to figure out who we are, for us to understand our identity or develop a sense of identity by looking at ourselves. Think about this. Our brains are designed by God to figure out who we are, to embrace an identity by looking into the eyes of someone else or by having someone else look at us and tell us, this is who you are. And I develop a secure sense of self. I develop healthy attachment when I know I am loved, when I experience this sense of connection with an irreplaceable other who has good intentions for me. So again, mirroring, very important. It's critical to healthy child development. Mirroring is also critical to healthy faith development. I want us to read this verse together, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1. It's on the screen. Read it out loud with me. Imitate God, therefore, in everything you do, because you are his dear children. And as we've been talking about, early childhood development, parents and children, they're mimicking, they're repeating, they're copying, they're imitating behavior. It's mirroring. And the same is true for us as followers of Jesus. Think scriptures are really clear on this. We love because God first loved us. And just embedded in that verse and that idea is this idea of mirroring. That God does something and then we respond in a like manner. We imitate what God is doing. We mirror what God is doing, the behaviors of God in our life. Now, one final detail about mirroring. For children, mirroring is not just something that helps them identify a behavior or know what is happening. Mirroring is helpful to children as they understand what does the behavior mean? Or why someone is doing what they are doing. Let me give you an example of why this is important. If I were to stand up here and just start flailing my arms around haphazardly, no real meaning to this movement, right? Your mirror neurons are firing. Can you feel that? But that's all that's happening. They notice a behavior, but then it kind of stops there. But if I were to do this, grab a bottle of water and take the lid off it and raise it to my mouth and drink. And do it again. Your mirror neurons are firing, but they're also lighting up neural pathways that have been developed over the course of your life that allow you to predict what's going to happen. Because you are able to make a connection, what you are seeing, and then the meaning behind it, why it's happening. This is important. Over the course of your life, you need to learn when someone grabs a water bottle, that does not mean they're going to throw it at me. Right? You understand why the meaning behind the behavior is really important? Hang with me for just a second. Because this is going to be really crucial when it comes to living a life of faith. If we're going to imitate God in everything we do, it can't be simply about doing the things that God does. We have to understand why, what is the meaning behind what God is doing. Okay? So let's look at some behavior of Jesus. First time that Jesus meets Peter, it gets recorded in John chapter 1, verse 42. And here's how it's written. Looking intently at Simon, Jesus said, "Your name is Simon, son of John, but you will be called Cephas," which means Peter. Notice the behavior of Jesus. Looking, but it's a special kind of looking. Looking intently. And what we'll see in all of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they will take time in various moments and circumstances and encounters that Jesus has. The gospel writers will take time to make it very clear to us, Jesus is doing this. He's behaving this way. He's looking at someone intently. He's really seeing them. Here's some other examples. One time there's a guy named Jairus. He's a really important guy in the community where he lives, and his 12-year-old daughter is sick. So Jairus goes to Jesus, "Will you heal my daughter?" And Jesus and Jairus begin to walk to Jairus' home, and because Jairus is an important man, there's a huge crowd of people following, wondering what's going to happen. Well, Matthew tells us in the middle of the crowd, there's a woman who has been suffering from uncontrollable bleeding for 12 years. And she's in the crowd because she thinks, if I can just get close enough to Jesus, if I can make my way through the crowd that I can touch Jesus, maybe that'll heal me. And that's what she does. She touches the hem of his garment, and when she does, Jesus feels healing power leaving him. And he stops and he asks, "Who touched me?" Jesus turned around, and when he saw her, he said, "Daughter, be encouraged. Your faith has made you well." And the woman was healed at that moment. So we see Jesus doing something. We see that similar behavior, looking intently, seeing someone. But I want you to look for a little deeper meaning behind what's happening here. A big part of what Jesus does throughout his ministry, Jesus has to clean up some bad theology. And so part of the bad theology of the religious world of Jesus' day was people believed if you have a physical ailment, if you have an illness or a disease, if your body's not working the way it's supposed to work, that's probably a sign that God is cursing you for some sin in your life. And so people wanted to stay away from sinners. The sinners are unclean. And this woman has been uncontrollably bleeding for 12 years. In that religious context, she was unclean. Like, she would have had to live outside the city wall, disconnected from community. So she's taken a really big risk to come into town, to make her way through the crowd, to try to get close to a holy man. She's not supposed to do that. When Jesus saw her, what does he call her? Daughter. They're on their way to the home of this really important man named Jairus, who has a daughter who is sick. And everyone cares about this important man's daughter. Nobody cares about this woman who's been suffering for the last 12 years. But Jesus does. Jesus sees her and he calls her daughter. The meaning behind what Jesus is doing, he's trying to elevate her. He's trying to say she is same as. And she's worthy of love, connection. Another story that has kind of a similar reality is in Luke chapter 13. Luke tells us Jesus is at a really crowded synagogue on the Sabbath day teaching, and there's a woman in the crowd who for 18 years has been unable to stand up straight. She's been bent double for 18 years. So 18 years ago would have been September of 2006. What were you doing in September of 2006? I came from the Quad Cities to Ankeny to interview for a job as a pastor at Lutheran Church of Hope in September of 2006. Can you imagine if for the last 18 years I've been unable to stand up straight? It was terrible suffering. And when Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Dear woman, you are healed of your sickness." Again, What does Jesus do? It's not just that he sees her, this woman who's been excluded, this woman that everybody's looking at as a sinner because of her physical condition. Let's stay away from her. Let's be disconnected from her. Jesus calls her over. He is seeing people and looking at people in a way that leads to connection with an irreplaceable other who has intentions for their good. One final story. Mark chapter 10 is the story of the rich young ruler. And at the end of the story of the rich young ruler, Jesus says to his disciples, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a wealthy person to enter the kingdom of God. And the disciples are upset, confused, right? They don't understand what is Jesus talking about. Because again, Jesus is cleaning up some bad theology. The bad theology that says if you're poor, that's a sign that God is cursing you, punishing you for some sin in your life. And if you're rich, it's clearly a sign God is blessing you. Wealthy people, they basically have one foot in heaven already. And then Jesus is doing stuff that doesn't quite align with that theology, and it's confusing. So they ask Jesus, his disciples ask him, well, then who can be saved? Jesus looked at his disciples intently and said, humanly speaking, it is impossible, but not with God. Everything is possible with God. So again, what we see Jesus doing, all of the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, make specific mention of this. They want to draw our attention to this behavior of Jesus. He really looks at people. He looks at people intently. Jesus sees people. He sees them. He sees us in a knowing, relational kind of way. Sometimes the gospel writers say Jesus knew what they were thinking. Jesus knew what was in their hearts. Not because he's some kind of a miracle worker, but because he pays attention to people. He sees, he observes, he knows. And there's meaning behind it. There's another example. This is the final example from earlier in the story of the rich young ruler. This guy comes to Jesus with a question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says, you know the commands. And the guy says, yeah, I've followed all these commands since I was a little boy. I want us to read together how Jesus responds in verse 21. It's on the screen. Read it out loud with me. Looking at the man, Jesus felt genuine love for him. What is Jesus doing in all these examples? Why do the biblical writers want us to understand that Jesus really looks at people intently? Jesus sees people. Jesus is practicing mirroring. With every human being he encounters, he is looking at them in a way that helps them know, I have a connection. When Jesus looks at me, I have a connection with an irreplaceable other who has intentions for my good. It's a look of genuine love. And it's the kind of love that helps us know who we are. It gives us our identity. And in a couple of the stories we looked at, it's the kind of love that leads to healing in our lives. That kind of connection. The Greek word that gets used for love here in the story of the rich young ruler, but also in our Bible reading in Romans 12, love each other with genuine affection. It's the Greek word agape. Can we all say that out loud together? Agape. Agape love, we almost always talk about it as unconditional love, but it's a lot bigger and richer than that. What's interesting is this is the word for love the New Testament writers use more than any other word, agape love. But agape is not a word that shows up very much in Greek literature of Jesus' day, of the biblical world. They had a lot of other words for love. They would use agape occasionally, but not very often. And so what a lot of biblical scholars are convinced of, remember, Jesus and his early followers, they were Jewish. So they knew the Hebrew scriptures. And they're trying to figure out, how do we communicate a very Hebrew idea about love to this Greek-speaking culture? So they latched onto the word agape because they're trying to help them understand a Hebrew idea of chesed. And we talk about chesed around here every once in a while. Chesed is one of the Old Testament words for love. It's one of the words that God uses to describe the kind of love that God has. Shows up all over the place in the Old Testament. One of my favorite verses where chesed shows up, chesed love, is in Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 3. You see it on the screen. Let's read this out loud together. I have loved you, my people, with an everlasting love. With unfailing love, I have drawn you to myself. What does Jesus say? He sees that woman and he calls her over. The kind of love that Jesus has when he looks at someone is the kind of love that's always drawing him, drawing us, drawing others into connection with him. Unfailing love, agape love, chesed love. It's the kind of love at the end of Psalm 23 that says, it pursues us every day of our life. It's this love that has good intentions for us. It's this love that seeks us out. It's this love that we just sang about. There's no shadow you won't light up, no mountain you won't climb up. God's love is coming after you. There's no wall it won't kick down, no lie it won't tear down. God's love is coming after you. And God's love wants to draw you into this relationship where you know, where you feel safe and secure, knowing you are connected to an irreplaceable other who has intentions for your good. Have you experienced that kind of love? Can you remember a time in your life where God's love hit you kind of like that? We love because God first loved us. The love for everyone always, the loving people with genuine affection, it has to flow out of our own experience of God's love for us. So we're going to practice that. I know some of you hear the music, you think, oh, the sermon's about over? Oh, this was short. No, it's not. This is a message series called Seven Habits of Highly Effective Christians. So I want to give you three habits that you can begin practicing right now today so that you can experience God's love and then share that love. The first habit I want you to start practicing looking at people the way Jesus looks at people. Have you seen these memes that are all over social media? I find them hilarious. Find someone who looks at you the way Joey Tribbiani looks at a meatball sandwich. Or find someone that looks at you the way Waylon looks at Willie. Do you see that affectionate gaze there? Michael Scott on The Office. Find someone who looks at you the way Michael Scott looks at Jim and Pam. What I've been trying to do as we've been walking through this behavior of Jesus, I've been trying to convince you you found someone who looks at you like that. It's your God. It's Jesus Christ, your Lord and Savior. He looks at you with this gaze of genuine affection. He wants you to know, he wants you to experience that kind of connection that tells you who you are. That you know, that you know, that you know there's a God who loves you, and no matter what happens in your life, you're going to be fine, you're going to be okay because God loves you. And then you can start to share that love with others. So the practice is to start looking at people, not this way, not in a socially, my next staff meeting, the staff's all going to just be staring at me. No, there's a difference between people watching and looking at people the way Jesus looks at you. People watching is not about love, it's about judgment. Can't believe they left the house looking like that. So what does it mean for us to look intently at someone the way, to see people the way Jesus sees people? There's an author, a New York Times bestselling writer. His name is David Brooks. One of his latest books is How to Know a Person. Look at the subtitle here. The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen. That's what we're talking about. I heard somebody say one time, love means paying attention. I wonder what you're paying attention to when you look at people, when you see people. What if you could look at people through kind of this filter? Every person you look at is a person created in the image of God. Every person you look at is someone Jesus willingly chose to go to the cross and suffer and die so that that person could experience God's love. What if we could learn to look at people and see people through that kind of lens? It's not normal for us. It doesn't come easy or naturally. We have to practice it. So we're going to practice it right now. Lindsay's going to be playing this song, Reckless Love of God, the love that loves everyone always. And I asked the production team to turn the cameras on you. So we're going to put you on the screen. We're going to practice mirroring, all right? And we're just going to kind of slowly pan around the room. And I want you to practice looking intently, seeing people the way Jesus looks at people. I'm not going to ask you to do anything I won't do myself, so I'll sit down and put myself through this too. Did you feel something change in the room when we did that? When we start looking at people, trying to see them the way God sees them, trying to see ourselves the way God sees us. So that's the first habit you can begin practicing. Look at people the way Jesus looks at people. Second practice, second habit, we got to become people who have the right kind of delight. So the beginning of Romans 12:10 says, love each other with genuine affection. Here's how it ends. Let's read this out loud together. Take delight in honoring each other. Let's read that one more time. Take delight in honoring each other. I don't know what your sense is, but my sense is we live in a particular time and place in human history where our preference seems to be taking delight in dishonoring each other. Did you watch the presidential debates on Tuesday night? I watched, first of all, as a voter interested in what do the candidates have to say. And then I also watched as a pastor interested in how people are going to respond to what the candidates for president have to say. And I got to tell you, here's what I observed. I observed a lot of Democrats taking great delight in dishonoring the presidential candidate from the Republican side, and I saw a lot of Republicans taking great delight in dishonoring the Democratic candidate. And I hear your objections already, some of you. No. I'm not dishonoring anyone. I am simply pointing out the way they are dishonoring God. Here are the ways that dishonoring, these are the Republican policies that dishonor God. These are the Democratic policies that dishonor God, and somebody's got to call them out on it. Okay. I don't know your heart. I don't know your intent. But I think pastorally this would be my follow-up question. Would you like it if someone called out the way you dishonor God in a similar fashion? Would you like it if someone called out your sin in a similar way that you're calling out the sin of the presidential candidates you don't like? David Brooks in this book says, as a society, we have failed to teach the skills and cultivate the inclination to treat each other with kindness, generosity, and respect. And there's all sorts of reasons for this. There's all sorts of people who can share the blame on this one. I think churches should take some of the blame on this. I mean, who should be teaching people how to treat each other with kindness, generosity, and respect if it's not the church? But for some reason, it's not happening, all kinds of reasons, and one of the reasons is technology. And this is not Pastor Scott saying technology is terrible and we need to do away with all technology. This is Pastor Scott saying, as followers of Jesus, as people who are trying to grow as disciples, are we paying attention to how technology either helps that process or hinders that process? So again, this neurotheologian, Dr. Jim Wilder, was quoting research that says the average American today spends 8 to 12 hours a day interacting with screens. And we've been spending a lot of time in our community the last several months talking about how kids, how students interact with screens. And then that way we don't have to think about how we interact with. Let's just talk about how kids do it. This is 8 to 12 hours a day. This is parents, adults, this is all of us. Now, what happens when we interact with screens? Do you ever think about that? The screens we interact with are not particularly interested in us. The screens we interact with don't particularly care what we think or what we feel. If our screens are paying attention to us, it's only for the sake of being able to send us some targeted ads to get us to buy something. So our screens don't love us. Our screens are using us. Our screens are just not that into us. Here's part of what this means. You and I are training our brains for several hours a day to engage with someone who is not interested in us. And when we spend that much time with someone who's not interested in us, we don't develop the skills to learn when I'm in an actual face-to-face, person-to-person interaction, what are the skills necessary to show that I'm actually interested in them? And this, of course, leads to disconnection and isolation and loneliness. And Jesus has a better way. So what can we practice? What habits can we start engaging in that help us learn how to pay attention and show interest in another human being? Here's a pretty easy one. Learn to ask good questions. Learn to ask good questions. If you ask someone a good question, it just explodes the delight in that relationship. So we had the new member class last weekend, and the first thing they do is they sit around tables, they eat a meal, but we ask them a question. What is your hope story? Just share with the people around the table. How did you end up here at Hope? And it starts to build connection. Then they move forward for the teaching time, and they're in rows for the teaching time. And as the people were coming forward, I saw somebody who was wearing a Tampa Bay Buccaneers pullover. And I thought, who in Central Iowa is a fan of the Tampa? So I took it as an opportunity to go and ask a question at a very superficial level to begin making a relational connection. That's what questions can do. Learn to be people who ask good questions. In the book, David Brooks gives us five possibilities. And again, these are a little deeper kinds of questions than what's your favorite sports team, but the point is the same. How do we show interest and delight in what's happening in the life of another? So here's question number one. What crossroads are you at? What's the big decision you are facing in your life? And how are you going to determine which decision to make? Question one, what crossroads are you at? Question two, what would you do if you weren't afraid? You start to see there's a little vulnerability required when you ask these kinds of questions, but it shows that you're paying attention. It shows that you are interested. What would you do if you weren't afraid? Here's the next question. If you died tonight, what would you regret not doing? Good news, most of us aren't going to die tonight. Hopefully none of us will die tonight. Which means, if we would regret not doing it, well, then why are we not doing it? And what might our plan be to make it possible for us to start doing the thing we would regret if we never did it? I like this fourth question. If the next 5 years is a chapter in your life, what is that chapter about? If you're an elementary kid, the next 5 years might mean middle school. It might mean becoming a teenager. What's that next chapter going to be about for you? If you are a middle schooler now, the next 5 years is going to mean high school. What's that chapter going to be about? If you're in high school, what happens after graduation? What will that chapter be about? Maybe you just got married. Maybe you just became parents. Maybe you just became empty nesters. Maybe you just retired. If the next 5 years is a chapter in your life, what is that next chapter about? One final question. Can you be yourself where you are and still fit in? Still have that sense of belonging? So just five examples of questions. Maybe you don't like any of them. That's fine. Come up with your own questions. Learn to ask questions that show you are interested. Learn to ask questions that help you take delight in honoring the person who is in your presence in that moment. So, two habits we can start practicing. Look at people the way Jesus looks at people. Secondly, we want to learn to take the right kind of delight by asking good questions. And then the third habit we can begin practicing today is listening, and in particular, listening for the voice of God. This is a big question a lot of people have. How can I actually live a life of faith where I learn, is it even possible to hear the voice of God in my life? So the great commandment, love the Lord your God with everything you have and love your neighbor as you love yourself. That there's somehow, if we're going to actually be people who love others well with genuine affection, it has to start with, do we love ourselves well? Do we love ourselves the way God loves us? Last week, we talked about the habit of finding God's rhythm for our life. We looked at Jesus' rhythm of his life, which is this three-count rhythm of solitude and community and mission or service to the world. Count one of Jesus' rhythm of life is solitude, and solitude for Jesus is all about listening for the voice of God. In his baptism, he hears the voice, you're my dearly loved son, you bring me great joy. And time and again throughout Jesus' life, he leaves the crowds, he leaves his disciples, he gets away from all the busyness and all the noise so he can listen for that voice again. And again, a lot of people are like, well, what does God's voice sound like? How do I know it's God's voice and not some other voice? God's voice is a voice of affirmation and identity. Let me tell you who you are, and let me remind you that who you are is good. you're my dearly loved son. You bring me great joy. That's the voice of God for each of us. You're God's dearly loved child. God delights in you in all kinds of ways. So the way we're going to practice it is we're going to, like Jesus, get away from the noise, get away from the busyness, find some quiet time. Start with maybe 2 minutes. Grow up to 7 minutes. Again, at the beginning of the series, we said, the things we do do something to us, but it's slowly and over time. When you first start practicing listening for the voice of God, you are not going to like it, because what you will hear is your own voice and your to-do list and your grocery list and that thing that person said that's still rubbing me the wrong way and I'm so annoyed by it, I can't believe, or the thing that I said or the thing that I did, and I just feel so terrible and it's just eating me up. But why this practice is so important is slowly over time, those kinds of things get pulled out as we practice just quietly listening for the still small voice of God. All the other noises, all the other distractions, all the other things that we pay so much attention to, it gets pulled out and it makes room for us to hear the voice of God. Start by asking, Jesus, what do you want me to know about how you see me? If Jesus looks intently at people, if Jesus really sees people, what does Jesus see when he looks at you? Ask him, what do you want me to know about how you see me? You could rephrase it, who am I to you? And then have something where you can take notes, where you can write it down. What are the words that start popping into your mind? What are the phrases? What are the word pictures? And try not to make sense of it in the moment. You know, set your timer for 2 minutes or 7 minutes or 20 minutes. And when the timer goes off, then you can start to make sense of it. Then you can get together with someone else and say, help me make sense of. As we do this, as we engage in these practices, God's grace is going to be at work in us, helping us know we are forgiven, helping us know that this transformative process is underway. We're being formed into the image of Jesus Christ. We're becoming people who love everyone always. So let's stand together and let's sing the song. You could even begin these practices right now while we sing about God's love.